Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and today's program is going to be focusing on hunger issues. My guest in studio today is Anthony Butler. He is the Executive Director of St. John's Bread and Life. Tony Butler has worked in the field of social service and community organizing for over 30 years. He's been active on homeless issues for the past 20, particularly as they relate to technology's effect on services and housing. In June of 2005, Butler took the position as the executive director of St. John's Bread and Life, and during his tenure there, Bread and Life has grown to a $3 million annual budget and has served over 500,000 meals annually. As part of Bread and Life's commitment to providing nutritious food, it has grown its partnership with the sustainable food community. And over the past 2 years, Bread and Life has brought over $200,000 worth of sustainably grown New York State products into the community. It continues to partner with the Brooklyn and New York food community to address the issues of hunger and poverty. Welcome to the studio, Tony.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Now, before we started, came into the studio, you were talking about in the late 1970s, and I actually did a little research about this after we had that conversation, and it looked as though hunger was no longer going to be such a widespread issue amongst the poor, but that the Reagan budget cuts had had a profound impact on delivering services and dealing with hunger in the private sector. Can you take us back through that history?
And yeah, we were running, memory serves, in the late 70s, right till about 1980. Food stamp usage was up. Hunger was dramatically down. We were looking at about only 10% of folks were in the crisis of hunger, meaning they could not bring meals to their tables on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. In 1982... late 81, 82, the Reagan administration did dramatic cuts on the food safety network, dramatic cuts in TFAP, which is the food that comes into food pantries, dramatic cuts, particularly in food stamps. Just an anecdotal or an illustration of that. Prior, about 1980, 1981, in New York City, there were 16 emergency food providers, fundamentally soup kitchens, and dealt with what folks really consider soup kitchens, the classic kind of Bowery bum kind of mm-hmm. folks who are really marginal and having a real tough time making it, and poverty was their significant issue. By 1983, 1984, that had taken off, and by 84, there were some 1,600 emergency food providers in New York City.
Well, what was happening economically that... I'm trying to think about what was going on in the first years of the Reagan administration that would cause such an abrupt rise in
there was still
food insecurity.
The leftover of the recession from the Carter years. And that was still going on. And it was definitely it was a part of that whole trickle down. The idea was to reduce taxes, and the easiest way in some ways in our country to reduce taxes is to place the burden on the poor.
Uh-huh. Doesn't that sound familiar?
Yes.
God, where have I heard that before? Yeah. Unbelievable. So go on, tell us more. So you went up, the statistics rose dramatically.
The dramatic increase in statistics, an attempt, kind of an illusory attempt, that's when that whole kind of government cheese model came out, the idea that surplus foods could affect hunger. One of the issues that folks in our country need to understand about hunger is it's not like a third world country where they've had a great famine or a civil war or something and the crops are depleted. Hunger is a poverty issue in this country. Mm-hmm. And it's always been people making choices between food and rent, food and medical care, food and clothes for their kids. And without that kind of supplement, particularly food stamps, which is a very good supplement, they were not able to make ends meet. And what happened is the private community attempted to respond to that by mostly small churches giving out bags of groceries, sandwiches, and like mm-hmm. that, never having the kind of robust infrastructure to be able to do that.
It reminds me of those 1,000 points of light.
Yeah. Some of them aren't so bright right now.
Bush Daddy, Daddy Bush was always talking about those 1,000 points of light when he was running for election. It just doesn't work. I think the government must be involved in managing benefits like this. I don't really see any other way. So now, talking about, you know, things in the present, why don't you talk a little bit about the proposed cuts in the farm bill to SNAP benefits, because SNAP is the largest part of the farm bill. It's the biggest allocation in the farm bill. I think a lot of people think that it's actually crop insurance or crop subsidies, but it's really not. That's a very small fraction of what really makes up the farm bill. So what's going to happen when they take those big chunks out of the SNAP benefits?
Excuse me. What's happening right now in the SNAP benefits? SNAPs are actually food stamp. It's the supplemental nutritional something.
Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
Assistance Program. Thank you. bill that just was approved by the Senate and went to the House is proposing over 10 years to cut $4.5 billion in SNAP money. What that will do...
Over 10 years.
$4.5 billion. What that will do is, particularly in New York City, 40% of those who are hungry in New York City will be affected by that. It's about something like around 800,000 families who will lose $90 a month for groceries. And when you're only bringing in $230, $240 of groceries, you lose $90. It's a significant impact. The biggest people who will be hurt are people who receive other federal subsidies. So the biggest people who will be hurt are working families and seniors who receive, if they receive heating subsidies, if they receive Medicare, and which we forget that that's a federal subsidy. That will be offset, so they will lose their food stamps because the idea is they're receiving the Medicare money. So it'll be offset by that much.
So in other words, those people are only allowed to receive so much,
essentially,
from the government pie.
Exactly.
Okay.
There will be, what they're going to do is they're arguing to put $175 million of TFAP money. TFAP money is the money that food pantries receive, mostly kinds of lines of credit to purchase food. That is over 10 years, but that money's coming from the $4.5 billion. So if you do the math, $4.5 billion... and only putting $175 million back in.
Somebody's making some money here.
It's very disproportionate. And people need to know that the Farm Bill, food stamps support farmers.
Yeah.
That's the purpose of it. The purpose of it is that this money goes back into farm. It also, food stamps dramatically supports local economies. New York City 2 years ago, I don't know what the stat was last year, but 2 years ago lost almost $1 billion in food stamp money. That for eligible people, and that's $1 billion that could come in local supermarkets, local bodegas. That money circulates. I think the rough statistic is about 9 times. So every dollar grows ninefold. And so that's for municipalities. It's a tremendous hit because it reduces the amount of federal monies coming back in.
Very interesting. Well, that leads right to the next question.
The bill that's in front of the House is even more draconian.
Yes.
It's $12 billion over 10 years in cuts in the SNAP program.
So do you think we can expect to see food riots 10 years from now, unless the economy
conceivably
is
improves? We're getting this perfect stormish kind of thing, with 39 states I think are at drought risk right now. I mean, I'm just reading on CNN this morning that corn and soy prices are going through the roof.
Unbelievable. The highest prices ever. Corn is over $10 a bushel right now, and it's probably trading higher on the futures market. The prices of food are going to escalate dramatically, but we're not going to see those prices for about 10 months.
Right.
I read all those trade blogs too. And so you don't necessarily notice it right away, but you will be seeing like all of your livestock prices, all of the protein, chicken, pig,
and anything
cattle.
That's made with soy, which is everything we eat. Every
processed. Or corn.
Yeah.
And all of the processed foods that we eat and all of the snack foods. Of course, that might not be the worst thing in the world if that stuff becomes a little more expensive. But to go back to what we were talking about in terms of municipalities losing $1 billion, how good are New York's elected officials at advocating for the disadvantaged, particularly on the federal level?
And Senator Gillibrand's been very courageous in advocating, was on the House floor, or Senate floor, excuse me, advocating against these cuts. Unfortunately, without success, she's been very good, and also very good kind of working the macro picture on the federal level and working to support New York State farmers, which is one of the few growth industries in New York State, particularly outside of the cities in New York State.
Yeah.
So she's been very good with that.
What about Bloomberg and his nutrition initiative? What do you think of that? Do you feel like that's just pandering to the masses, or is that actually a real program that he's going to fund, and you know something is actually going to happen with that?
I think it's something. I don't think he's pandering. I think it's a. I don't know if it's terribly useful.
Uh-huh.
I think it's one of our mayor's strengths and weaknesses is his undying belief in technology,
mm-hmm.
that you can create a system and it will create change, as opposed to creating change and then creating a system to manage that.
I see. That's interesting.
So I don't know, and I don't know if liter sodas are our biggest concern right now.
Well, I think, I don't know. I'm glad that he did that. And and also today, when I was driving down here, he was on Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer, and he was talking about the tragedy in Colorado and the fact that, you know, the Congress, not he didn't say the Congress, he was pointing his finger directly at Obama and Romney about gun control and assault weapons being banned once again.
And I would give the mayor kudos, slightly off topic, but he does use his bully pulpit well.
Yeah.
Both by his wealth and his ability to get in the press and like that, very good and articulate around that, and fearless with that, too.
I think so, too. There are things about him I don't like, but I really do appreciate that. And I do feel like he's definitely got the welfare of the population, you know, close to his heart, as opposed to, you know, so many other politicians who are really all about lining their pockets or personal growth. What about Anthony Weiner? He's... throw this one in because I noticed like a headline saying that he was, you know, rumored to be considering a run for the mayor, you know, assuming that everybody's forgotten his underpants photo or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I really liked the guy. I was very sad when he blew himself up like that.
I did. There's always the question of judgment, you know. I mean, I do know he spent a lot of time in the gym when we saw that picture, but
he still didn't look that good.
But it's that question of what is his judgment, and my cynicism is, you know, there's a bit of, you know, he's doing the photo ops with his young child and like that. I get a little cynical. So I'm holding my judgment on Anthony Weiner, though he was, when he was in Congress, a very effective politician.
He was, and a very passionate about, you know, issues that he felt strongly about, and I really admired that and appreciated that in him. I loved the way he would beat up the rest of them.
Yeah.
Like throw a tantrum. I thought it was great. I just loved it. You know, great theater.
Yeah.
You were recently profiled in the Huffington Post, and you included this quote: "We have amazing supporters of Bread and Life, though the downside of this job is the worry about money, as I need to raise $3 million a year in order to respond to the current need, hunger needs here. The demand keeps growing, and we continue to see a rise in the number of working families needing our services." Can you put those demands into some kind of perspective? Like what
we're seeing?
Tell us about what you guys provide.
Yeah. At Bread and Life, we provide a hot meal program on site and a mobile soup kitchen, a truck that goes around to six different communities. And a food pantry that adds up to approximately 2,100, 2,200 meals per day. Our biggest increase has been in folks who are working, particularly young families. As I mentioned earlier in the conversation, they're folks who are just not making it, and it's really a scandal because these are folks who are working hard.
Yeah,
and that continues to grow.
What do you attribute that to? I mean, is that because housing is so expensive here?
Housing and the lack of real wage growth since the late 70s.
Right.
We've shifted. I mean, anecdotally, you can see that in 1979, a single person could provide for their family. One income, you cannot do that now. It demands a two-income household, then it demands child care, and so on and so forth.
Right. I can see how that would really add up. Absolutely. And so given that you depend on private donations rather than government funding, does politics play a big role in fundraising and, you know, finding money for the organization?
My whole life is asking people for money. If we were doing television, everyone could see my gray hair.
They'd see that winning smile, too, Tony. I can see why you work, why you're so successful at
it. But we do depend on folks, I think, believing that they can invest in this mission and believing that a community is something to invest in.
Mm-hmm.
We're only running right now about 9% government funding. The rest is all privately raised between foundations and individuals.
God, that's incredible. Yeah. $3 million.
Yeah.
That's really so impressive. That says something about what a smooth talker you are, Mr. Butler. Carlos, I think we should take like our 30-second sponsor drop. We'll come right back with Anthony Butler of St. John's Bread and Life. This is Katie Kiefer on Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. Stay tuned.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
We're back.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry about that. Sorry, Carlos, and sorry to everybody out there. This is Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network, and we are speaking with Anthony Butler today, the Executive Director of St. John's Bread and Life, which is a sort of multi-service organization based in Bushwick. No, in Bed-Stuy.
Bed-Stuy.
So, Tony, one of the things that you have done recently is you developed this really cool piece of technology in managing your food pantry and making its contents available to clients so they can sort of shop online. Can you tell us a little bit about that product, like what you do and, I mean, how they use it?
Sure. If I give a little background, when I took this job in 2005, I Googled best practices in emergency food, and there weren't any. There was all kinds of information on how many fat people there were, how many hungry people there were, food deserts and lack of fresh produce, and so on and so forth. I thought maybe we could look at some information and see what kind of change agent we could be. As we grew and built our new building, our new $8 million facility, I wanted to bring technology into it because I thought that was the only way to do it. And I also thought that there's a bias against technology in poor communities. People thought I was kind of crazy to do this. There's some bias that poor communities, if you will, are too stupid to use technology. We wanted to give people choices with food because people should be able to choose what they eat. And to do that, we created a digital food pantry. This digital food pantry is composed of people receive basically a debit card with points on it. They swipe it on a screen, up pops the food pyramid, and they choose what grains we have in stock, what meats, so on and so forth. It allows us, too, to tie into our case management database because we provide robust services to work to get people off of emergency food. Yeah. That's really our goal. And it has allowed me to collect usage data. It's amazing. When we first opened, we moved to our new building. It was right when the recession hit. We had a 74% increase in the amount of folks coming. It was just insane. We only had a 62% increase in the amount of food they were taking because we realized when we give choice, people actually took less.
Wow, how interesting.
I mean, we may have been doing the insulting thing of giving pork to the Muslims or just giving stuff that people didn't like, wasn't culturally sensitive. So we developed this. It's allowed us to capture data. It's allowed us to streamline our process. We've been able, with the same staff, to handle over these 4 years almost a 38% increase in the number of people coming through. We've grown the system. The system now allows us to target foods to nutritional groups. If someone has hypertension, they can see the low salt. If someone's living in a rooming house and only has a microwave to cook with, they can see those products that be cooked in a microwave. We have the capacity to do halal food. We have the capacity to do kosher food. If we have an issue, say, obesity or something, we can target more dietetic food. And all this technology has allowed us to do that. We're in the process of creating another iteration of this software that will be completely web-based, with the idea that I can put it in any municipality or any location. People can put their order and the food can be delivered.
So any food pantry that wants to use this application can go on the web and key in what their products are in their food pantry.
We could do it.
And then their clients can basically do the same thing that your clients are doing at St. John's.
And it will be completely web interface, so the cost structure will be low. It's allowed us to completely track our inventory, make much better use of, as we talked earlier about donations, a much more efficacious use of folks' donations on ordering, keeping real time, less spoilage. One of the things we do, too, is that if the more nutritious stuff, if you will, is cheaper, or if I get a huge donation, say, from a city harvest or a food bank, say I get a whole bunch of lettuce, which is rather perishable, I can make that either very cheap or very free to move it.
Right.
Our next iteration also will allow us to put recipes with certain products to encourage people to use them if they might be knowledgeable of those products and how to cook them.
Yeah, I love that idea. I actually was talking to Christy. We're going to be doing a little business together later on in the season. But so where do most of your food donations come from? What's the typical breakdown of that? Is it from, it's not from individuals, it's from corporations or from City Harvest? Or?
Yeah, our food donations come from City Harvest, which is a very large food rescue organization here in New York City. They come from Food Bank, which is another procurer of food.
Those are primarily packaged goods?
Food Bank primarily packaged goods and canned and like that, though moving to more fresh produce. City Harvest a significant amount of fresh produce. Mm-hmm. We do some private donations, you know, the Scouts Food Drive and local community school food drive. I encourage those as a way of kind of fostering commitment to this
sure,
kind of
engagement.
Work.
Engagement, yeah.
But actually, if people give me cash, I can... It's much more efficacious because I can buy stuff cheaper. We're spending, though, this year, as you alluded to in the introduction, we're spending probably about $300,000, $350,000 in cash. About $200,000 of that will be spent on New York State-grown produce.
That's fantastic. So that's quite a nice little shot in the arm to the local economy. Now, if you had some opportunity to change, you know, part of some of the donations that you see coming in, what would you want? You'd want more fresh produce?
More fresh produce.
Do you get meat?
We do get meats. We're actually in a process of expanding so we can handle more meats because there's refrigeration needs and like that.
Yeah.
We do get meats. We had a huge... It's amazing the stuff I've had to learn about commodities. We had a huge influx of chicken last year because the Russians didn't buy chicken.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And it was sort of their loss and our gain that all this chicken was grown.
Fascinating.
We've had farmers, because we're able to handle tractor trailer loads, we've had farmers from Florida bring up stuff because some deal fell through and they didn't want to destroy the crops.
Mm-hmm.
Effective government supports is the HPNAP funding, Hunger Nutrition Assistance Program, which is a New York State-funded program. New York State spends annually roughly $30 million giving out money that fundamentally goes to food, to nonprofits. I was up at a HPNAP conference, and and there was a research project being done by Harvard. And New York State gives more emergency food money than any other state in the union. It also is the only state in the union that is under the threshold of the four childhood health indicators of obesity, hypertension, malnutrition, and growth, age-appropriate growth. It's not the technical term. And there seems to be some correlation that this money is being spent. One of the things that the legislatures, when I went up to, I have to go up and ask for this money, is I did make a commitment to spend the money in New York State because I think tax money should come back locally. I think it's being an effective director, an effective steward of the money. And
yeah,
so
that makes sense.
That's been
to
an
me.
Appropriate, very effective program.
So you've developed all these different kinds of alliances with farmers groups. Mm-hmm. Do you work with Grow NYC also?
Yes,
And is this part, so this not only goes into your soup kitchen products, whatever you make for the daily meals, but also out into the food pantry?
We do. We put it in the food pantry. And to kind of encourage, one of the things we have regularly, we have a demonstration kitchen that does cooking classes. And
oh, really?
Yeah. She's so bad.
Yeah.
I'll make you come over and cook.
I can't wait. I'm serious. I'm going to do it.
Because like most of America, there's a dearth of cooking knowledge out there among a lot of folks and how to use those products. So we do work to bring those into our food pantry and our soup kitchen. And we've really tried to develop an alliance with the food community. The farmers, the restaurateurs, the purveyors, the people doing kind of value-added stuff. Because I believe the food community does a tremendous job of responding to the hunger needs of people with means. They have some obligation to respond to the hunger needs of people without means.
I think you're right, Tony. I agree with that. I don't think anybody would argue, unless maybe you're a large restaurateur. But I know a lot of these guys give away time, money, product on a regular basis. Yeah. In fact, I think it's one of the great, the worst, best kept secrets in the food community is just how much time, especially the big chefs.
Yeah.
Eric Repair, I know, for instance, is a tireless donator of time and services to lots and lots of different charity organizations. Mm-hmm. And of course, he's on the board of City Harvest. So, And he's on something else. Anyway, doesn't matter. But he's just one of the many.
Many.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's very exciting. It helps me because I'm the accidental kind of food guy, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't have a background in food.
No, no.
You have a background in basically managing
Nonprofit,
you know, organizations.
I developed homeless housing for years, and so now moving to this.
Well, I hope this becomes a blueprint for success because, I mean, just the whole, I mean, what you were describing earlier about your digital food pantry and the way that you can, track products and track the population and what their needs are, and that in the end, this has actually saved money.
Yes.
I think is just extraordinary. I mean, it really makes such a big difference where every dollar counts. I can see how that would have a very large impact over time.
One of the things we've launched is, we're calling it Direct Express, which is probably not the best name, but for folks who are really trying to get on their feet and doing the right thing. They might be working part-time, they might be going to some kind of program, they might be going to school, and they can't come when our food pantry hours are open. Mm-hmm. They can come in very early, put their order, and then pick it up later.
Wow.
Because we want to encourage the folks who are trying to get out of this this need in this system.
Yeah. What about the people who aren't?
It's a good question. It's a good question. I don't believe we will solve poverty. I think if we could solve poverty, I'd be a very wealthy person if I could come up with that system.
Yep.
But you do need to encourage people. But we do operate, St. John's Bread and Life operates based on the value of the individual person. It's not a means testing or anything like that. The people are inherently valuable and that people inherently have a right to food.
Yeah, absolutely. This country, it's just a scandal that anybody should be food insecure. It's beyond belief. Tony, let me see if I have one more question for you. I think basically we still have a few minutes here. So what's next for you guys? Well, first of all, let's talk a little bit more about some of the other services, because it's not just food at St. John's. You deliver a whole range of services, So can you talk a little bit about those? Yeah. And then
we saw roughly 9,000 folks for services outside of food out of our 22,000, I think we saw last year. We have an immigration clinic on site. We have we can do food stamp application, Medicaid application. We have medical services on site. We have legal services. One of the things that's been developed, we partner with St. John's University, and been developed by the students, is a thing called Project ID to help folks get their non-driver's ID, their birth certificate, social security cards.
So they can vote.
Exactly. Though it's funny, that's what it started as. It started as a voter registration. We found out people were getting voter cards as a piece of ID. We said that's not the best ID for that purpose. But it is to drive voting, and it's to drive them because identification bars you from so much. You can't get in half the buildings in this city without a piece of photo ID. You can't fly.
You can't
get into Social Security to apply for your Social Security without ID.
Oh my God.
So you can kind of get stuck there.
Yeah, you sure can. Yeah. Yeah.
And our work we do, that's a student run. Our immigration law clinic is a student run. We provide free tax. We did about $3 million in free tax prep for folks last year so they could get their tax money back. And a lot of these, we do a lot of work with students because it's very exciting to have students come and not just serve food, but use their skills that they're training for and studying for, hopefully to plant the seed of their social responsibility in the future.
Well, I think you must be doing a good job. I mean, the fact that you can get students to come in, volunteer, and do that, once a week or whatever they do, it's really extraordinary. And so what's next for you guys? What's your next... big. You're doing an expansion.
We're doing a physical expansion of some space that we had carved out to now we can handle. We're building a larger demo kitchen, more storage capacity for food.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing a very large research project, which hopefully published in the fall, to see what the impacts of our technology and our approach to anti-poverty, if it's working, where it's not, where it is.
Uh-huh.
We've spun off the digital food pantry into a separate company, so we can move that into other municipalities.
And will that be a profit? Will that be a moneymaker for you? Will you be able to derive some income from that?
I'm hoping. Nonprofit businesses to make money have never terribly succeeded with. Yeah. It won't be a money loser.
Right.
We would not do it as that. We hope to.
But it would become a little bit of a revenue stream, like a royalty or something like that.
Oh, yes.
That just helps
we'll
you
control
fund
software.
Yeah, exactly. That's pretty exciting.
But to continue, one of the things, we've got 2 seconds just to add on, is our advocacy work. We have a community advocacy board that's met with the politicians, met with Senator Schumer, met with retiring Congressman Towns, because I've told the folks we serve, the poverty issue doesn't deeply affect me, it affects you. And so you've got to get out there and use your voice. And to be able to help them and learn how to navigate this, that some of us take for granted how to navigate the structures. They're learning how to, and it's very exciting that the community is bringing their kind of resources and their power to bear on the problem.
That's amazing. So in closing, Tony, what do you see happening in the next election? Do you think we're going to... Do you think Obama's going to win? And
I think he's going to sneak through. Barely. I think he is, because I don't think Romney is a terribly strong candidate. It's always going to be that 10% swing voters who will do it. It's important for people to get out to vote. I see things getting worse in terms of the separation between the very wealthy and those without. And as we talked about earlier, I think we're moving into a food crisis, particularly as food moves more and more and more as a commodity.
Yeah, absolutely. I think food should be taken out of the commodities market altogether. I see no reason why companies that are already making mad money should be making more money on and thus driving the prices up for, you know, average consumers as well as those who are living below the poverty line. So anyway, well, we will close with that, and I'll be back next week with an unknown guest as yet. Maybe Tony. We can find lots more to talk about. But my guest today has been Anthony Butler, the executive director of St. John's Bread and Life in Bedford-Stuyvesant. And thanks a lot for coming by, Tony.
Well, thanks.
And people should check out the website, because it's really an amazing organization that you're running there.
Great.
Thanks for doing it.
Thank you.
And thank you, Carlos. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye, folks.